Imagine if Washington, D.C. were on lockdown for days. Businesses, schools, transportation shut down completely and indefinitely. What would that mean for the economy of the city and the mood of the nation? Well, that's basically what's happening in Brussels right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, November 23rd, and we are so glad you could join us. Before we get to Brussels, the merger that everyone is talking about, the one where Botox and Viagra finally hook up. Or, put more professionally, the boards of pharma giants Pfizer and Allergan have agreed to a merger worth about $160 billion. The companies say the deal will cut costs by $2 billion and, of course, marry some of the world's most successful drug brands. The deal is also one of these merger types you might have heard a lot about lately. It's called an inversion. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is here to explain what that is.
You might remember that a couple of years ago, the French actor Gérard Depardieu got Russian citizenship to avoid his native country's hefty taxes. Inversions are sort of a corporate form of that.
U.S.-based corporations have to pay tax overseas to the country in which they're doing business and back to the United States when they bring that money back.
Kyle Pomerleau is the director of federal projects at the Tax Foundation. He says other countries tend to have much lower tax rates. So if a U.S. company moves its official address to the home of its new partner, voila, lower tax bill. The U.S. has been trying to prevent these types of deals. But Steve Rosenthal with the Tax Policy Center says the Pfizer-Allergan merger won't run afoul of current tax law.
The combination only leaves the Pfizer shareholders with 55 or 56% of the new company, not the 60% threshold that's required to trip these anti-inversion rules.
So the new company can keep Allergan's Irish home, but it'll still look a lot like Pfizer, says Eric Gordon, a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
The new company will change its name to Pfizer.
Wait, what?
Pfizer's still going to be run from 42nd Street in New York, but it's who owns how much of the company that counts.
The new Pfizer will also keep its old CEO and stock symbol. Gordon says to truly crack down on inversions, Congress would need to reform the tax code. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As you heard at the top of the show, Brussels, Belgium has been on lockdown for the past 3 days because of what authorities call a serious and imminent threat of a terror attack. Public transit, schools, theaters, museums, and shopping malls, all of those are closed. And it's unclear when the threat might actually be lifted and what economic impact the shutdown will have on the city and the EU. The BBC's Alex Forsyth is in Brussels right now. Alex, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So what does it look like in Brussels right now? I imagine the streets are very quiet.
Yeah, it's a very strange atmosphere here, really. You know, remember that this city is normally a working city, a really functional city. But right now, it really is quiet. I think that's the thing you notice most. I mean, I'm looking out the window now, just outside the European Commission, which is obviously one of the central buildings in this European bit of Brussels. And you'd expect normally to see dozens of people making their way home, waiting for buses, that kind of thing. And I can see right now, one person on the street. So I think a lot of people are heeding the advice of the authorities to stay in. There's not everybody. I mean, of course, some people are determined to go about their business as usual, but it's definitely quieter. And that means there's a real kind of tension in the air, a really nervous atmosphere here.
I'm sure. And can you tell me what, if anything, you've seen that is open today?
Well, there are still restaurants and cafes that are open, but they're very different. I went into one cafe, which is normally a huge queue where you have to pay to get your lunch. And, you know, I got to the counter really quickly. Yesterday, you know, I went to a really popular cafe for a coffee and it's got these huge windows that look out onto the street. And normally you can't get a table near the windows, but I was able to sit right in one because there are just fewer people around. At the same time, you know, there are plenty of people that you speak to that say, yeah, I am nervous. I am worried about this, but it's not going to stop me going to work. We don't know how long this heightened security will last. So, you know, if I stop living my life now, then it may be that that runs into days or even weeks or longer.
Well, and like you said, there's no sense of when things might get back to normal. How much, it's obviously hard to estimate now, but if you can guess, how much damage might this do over time to the Belgian economy?
You know, there are people that have suggested that the authorities are doing this as a show of strength to show that they can respond to these kind of threats, that they've got the power to do so, and that they're putting the safety of the citizens first. But actually, you can't imagine that the authorities would be doing this unless they had genuine cause to believe there was a real threat because of the damage to the economy. You know, shops, businesses, bars closed. Brussels has a huge tourist economy as well. And you think this, we're now on Monday, there may be people reconsidering trips for the weekend and perhaps even further beyond. So the economic and reputational damage that this could do are significant. But it's down to the individuals to make the choice about what they do with that information. There are some people that are saying, look, I feel safer to stay at home. There are others saying the only way that I can defeat this terror is to go out and carry on my business regardless. And that to them is their way of standing up to the threat.
Mm-hmm. And then there are some who are sending cat tweets. I cannot let you go without talking about the cat tweets. Yeah. What was that about? A small bit of rebellion, yes.
Absolutely right. So Brussels has obviously been the focus of much fairly intense police activity, not just in the past few days, right the way back to the days after the attacks in Paris, but this weekend in particular. So there were a number of raids in the city last night, and people on social media were tweeting movements of the authorities. Now, the police asked them not to, for operational reasons, i.e. don't give too much away about what exactly we're doing, because obviously they were hoping to make some arrests and do some searches of properties. Now, in response, Twitter did what Twitter does well. So instead of tweeting details about what the police were up to, people started tweeting pictures of cats. So this hashtag Brussels lockdown became taken over with images of cats. And that is, in a way, I guess, some small defiance saying, look, you may have changed our city for the last few days, but you won't change us permanently. We still have a sense of humour, and we're still prepared to put that out there.
That's Alex Forsyth from the BBC joining us from Brussels. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, Belgian stocks were actually up a tiny bit. Everything else, down a tiny bit. We'll have more when we do the numbers. We've been hearing a lot lately about student protests over racial issues on college campuses. Over the weekend in Los Angeles, students at Occidental College ended a nearly week-long sit-in when the administration agreed to increase funding for diversity initiatives. Students have forced changes at universities like Yale and the University of Missouri in Columbia. A frequent demand, resources for Black students and other ethnic minorities, like dedicated cultural centers. Yale did include student cultural centers in its new programs, and this week Brown University pledged $100 million to diversity efforts over 10 years, and that also included additional resources for the Brown Center for Students of Color. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports on the value of the campus cultural center.
When Jeffrey Beckham Jr. was in college, the Black Culture Center was a refuge on a predominantly white campus. It had everything from poetry readings and live jazz to study groups and networking opportunities.
As an African-American student, the Black Culture Center offered amenities and culture and comfort that you may have been hard-pressed to find in other areas of the campus.
That campus was the University of Missouri in Columbia, where earlier this month the chancellor and system president resigned after students protested their handling of racist incidents. Not long afterward, the sign at the Gaines Oldham Black Culture Center was vandalized. Beckham, who graduated in 2003, remembers seeing a Confederate flag flown from a dorm window. He says the Black Culture Center was much more than a place to hang out.
It effectively provided a social environment and a community that allowed you to connect with other students to do the ultimate thing that we were there for, which is matriculate through college and get a degree.
The first Black cultural centers emerged in the late 1960s as the civil rights movement led to a push to make college campuses more inclusive. Edward Pittman went to Vassar College in the early 1980s when the intercultural center was just a space in the basement of a dorm. He's now associate dean for campus life and diversity at the college, where today the expanded center has dedicated staff and programs like mentoring and career development. Pittman says students who feel connected and thrive are more likely to graduate.
I think cultural centers and faculty diversity are all factors that contribute to student persistence and student success.
At Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore, less than 6% of undergrads are black in this majority African-American city. Milena Berhana, a freshman representative of the Black Student Union, says the existing Office of Multicultural Affairs is a lifeline, but it's tucked away off the main campus.
I think having that space here would just show that black students and minorities in general are just all as important as everyone else.
Students plan to discuss moving the office, among other demands, with the university president next week. Last week, Princeton University said it would set aside rooms for cultural affinity groups and housing for students interested in black culture. Patricia Fernandez-Kelly is a senior sociology lecturer at Princeton and an advocate for diversity on campus. She worries that students seeking a safe space will self-segregate.
I think that does create very insular situations in which people are not interacting with a diverse population, which is what all of us have been fighting for such a long time.
But advocates of campus cultural centers say they're often the most inclusive organizations on campus. Vassar's Edward Pittman says when students of color feel supported, they're better able to navigate the dorms, dining halls, and classrooms where they spend most of their time. He says the ultimate goal is for every place on campus to feel as welcoming. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today is the day the public can start submitting comments to the FDA about their guidelines for labeling genetically modified food. That's because the FDA has just approved the first genetically modified animal product in the U.S. It's a fast-growing Atlantic salmon being developed by a Massachusetts company called Aqua Bounty. And according to current policy, the salmon won't have to have any special label identifying it as GMO. The question is how consumers will feel about it once it hits the market. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
You're not going to see farmed genetically modified Atlantic salmon at the grocery store or Red Lobster right away. It'll take Aqua Bounty a couple years to raise the fish in Panama. Then it'll just be a tiny fraction of the market. And many American consumers just don't like GMO foods. Only about a third think they're safe, according to Pew Research. Dominique Broussard is an expert on science and communication at the University of Wisconsin.
People have a tendency to equate the technology with something that they may not like. Big monopoly from corporations, very modern agriculture.
But modern agriculture, the idea of science healing the environment and feeding the planet, Broussard says that could be a marketing plus.
That it's more sustainable since we are already overfishing the oceans. It could be salmon that's much more affordable.
Animal geneticist Allison Van Enenam at UC Davis says GMO food animals might be more disease resistant, reducing the use of antibiotics. Her marketing message, all that whiz-bang genetic science, it just scares people.
We spend a lot of time talking about the technology rather than how it might benefit people and the planet.
There's just one problem with telling the positive story of GMO foods, though, in ads or on the packaging. There's no way for consumers to know they're genetically engineered. The food industry has fiercely resisted mandatory labeling, saying it's unnecessary and will put people off their gene-enhanced salmon and soybeans. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
instead of like physical labor where you're using your muscles to perform the work, you're using your emotions to perform the work.
When your job makes you put on a happy face and that makes you feel sad. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 31 points, a tenth percent, to close at 17,792. The NASDAQ lost 2 points, less than a tenth percent, to finish at 5102. The S&P 500 was off 2 points, a tenth percent, to end at 2086. Drug giant Pfizer and fellow drug maker Allergan both fell today as the two companies announced that merger we told you about earlier. Pfizer flagged 2.3% and Allergan dipped 3.4%. Worse than expected quarterly sales and profit hit GameStop.
The video games retailer lost 4.2%. Energy stocks powered upward. ExxonMobil spurted up 0.6%. Oil company Chevron gushed up 1.1%. And Transocean sailed up 0.7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.24%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its second estimate for third quarter gross domestic product. Tiffany, Campbell Soup, Hormel, and Guess are slated to report quarterly earnings. And the Conference Board issues its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Molly Wood. It is generally agreed that this week is when the holiday shopping season officially begins. Stores and malls around the country are already preparing for what I think we could call an onslaught. It even starts on the evening of Thanksgiving. Now, retail has had a tough go of it lately, especially big department stores that often anchor shopping malls. So last year, we spoke to Alana Furco, who manages the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. The mall had just lost its big anchor store, the JCPenney, and she was pretty worried about the future. So we thought we'd check in and see how this holiday season is shaping up. Alana, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Molly. It's nice to hear from you.
Okay, so we're less than a week away, actually, from the big Black Friday shopping day. How are things at the mall?
Well, we are. We're actually just days away. And we actually, we don't call it Black Friday in our world. We call it Golden Friday. We like to maintain a golden attitude. 50% of our businesses are mom and pops. So, you know, that's a very unique tenant mix for any kind of a mall. So we are just very excited about the season.
And is that has that been the way to recover from the kind of big anchor stores moving on is to fill the space with those smaller shops, like you said?
You know, I think so. I mean, we took ourselves way outside of the box. A new mall hasn't been built in the United States, I think, in at least 5, 6, maybe 10 years. And they are just modifying. And yes, there seems to be a resurgence of mom and pop stores. And our ownership is making some great deals so that we can fill the spaces, increase the activity level, and it just makes it better for all of us. Also, we have a library. We have a satellite to our public library. We have a couple of nonprofit organizations that we host here. So, yes, we are outside of the box, and, yes, we are bringing in more mom and pops.
And so, Alana, who's your primary competition? Is it big stores in town or is it the internet? Who's coming after you?
You know, I will tell you it is I-90 and I-15 because you can just jump on the interstate right here just north of the mall. And it's a beautiful ride to a couple of markets that are very competitive to us. But yes, it's also the internet. I mean, people can shop from the comfort of their own home. And most of these internet businesses are making it very easy to return. There's very little cost involved in shipping. That is my primary competition. No, not the big box stores. It isn't. Yeah, it's definitely the internet and the interstate.
And how does the mall compete with that? What do you do?
Service. You know, you don't get a smile from a computer. I mean, you don't get any FaceTime or chat time. It's service. We provide exceptional service, and that puts an emotional feel to it.
And how does the economy feel in Butte in general?
Economy is pretty good. We do have a gold mine that is shutting down in Whitehall, and so there will be a loss of some jobs there, but I think in general, and I know this back in 2008 when things were tough, people still wanted to have a good Christmas, you know, no matter how depressed things were. I mean, you just modify a little bit. Attitudes are very grateful, and I think it's going to be a great season. I can feel it already.
That's Alana Furco, manager of the Butte Plaza Mall, joining us from Butte, Montana. Thanks a lot, Alana.
Thank you, Molly.
Now,
Now, when you are shopping in those places like the mall or some store that's trying to provide you with in-person service and care, you will encounter a lot of apparently cheerful sales reps running around to help you with your shopping or eating or browsing needs. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, some of them may be working harder than you think.
This job, Kara O'Regan's job, will probably sound pretty familiar to a lot of people.
We were encouraged to be positive and to put a positive spin on things whenever possible.
She worked in retail sales, and the customers were, you know, not always very nice.
Their responses would be out of proportion to what was actually going on, taking their own stress and psychological distress out on us.
But she faked a positive attitude to do her job. And really, faking that attitude was her job.
Always with a smile on your face, a lot of clapping involved, that sort of thing.
Clapping?
Clapping for the customers, clapping for our coworkers, any excuse to applaud anyone.
There's a word for this faking it. It's called emotional labor.
Emotional labor is a type of work where instead of like physical labor, where you're using your muscles to perform the work, you're using your emotions to perform the work.
That's Alicia Grandy, professor of industrial organizational psychology at Penn State University. Now, it may sound like emotional labor is just a fancy word for, you know, all of life and every job ever, but Grandy says it's different.
It's an ongoing, constant expectation for 8 hours. It's the central aspect of what you're doing and whether you're doing it well.
And we do demand it as a society.
One of my coworkers was helping a customer.
This is Zach Hernandez. He's a barista.
Later, we found a posting on Yelp with this coworker's picture on it saying that he was coming across as unhappy, uncouth. They felt wronged by that.
Grandy's done research suggesting that faking happiness all day long is really emotionally taxing.
And that's been shown to create a lot of physical tension, which can then build up and create health issues. And over time, it can result in job burnout.
And she says the people asked to do this kind of work a lot of times are neither paid much nor respected.
Often these kinds of workers get mistreated by customers and they still have to maintain that smile. There's an uneven exchange.
I just remember being really angry all the time.
This is Kara O'Regan again, who worked in retail with the clapping and the smiley joy face all the time.
You know, being in traffic, I was angry. Standing online at the bank, I was angry, just angry, angry, angry all the time. I'm very stressed out and I was having nightmares. I was not able to leave it at the door at all.
The stress literally was making her sick. Alicia Grandy.
Do we really need to have this, you know, Mickey Mouse culture in America? Like this sense of like everything is like Disney where everyone's on stage at all times? Like, do we really need that? Can we just be real with each other every once in a while?
Now, faking your way through your job doesn't always have to be awful if you believe in it. Blake Ashforth is professor of management at Arizona State University.
I was talking to a dietitian, and she believes passionately in the importance of helping people lose weight. But sometimes her clients don't believe they're going to lose weight because it's hard to do. So she said, I've got to come across as very upbeat and positive, almost like a cheerleader.
Teachers who have to be patient with students, nurses who have to be positive for patients, for them, faking it is something to be proud of. The idea is that, yeah, you don't feel happy, but you believe that faking it is important and right.
If you get people who actually care about the job, and again, the job itself allows them to express themselves, there's autonomy involved in the role, and they have supportive management, a positive atmosphere, it can be a win-win.
Psychologists disagree about which is more important, the bright side or the dark side of emotional labor. But one thing they do agree on for employees and customers alike is showing the person on the other side some empathy. You never know the day someone's had. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
For a much longer conversation about emotional labor, check out the current episode of our podcast, Actuality. It's co-produced with Quartz and hosted by Sabri and Tim Fernholz. You can download it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts or at marketplace.org. And this final note before we go, I have seen the future, you guys, and in it, we are all sloth-like creatures attached to virtual reality or tablet screens, and our every need is met by an app or by a button, an actual physical button that we can press anytime we need something, like a pizza. Okay, I'm being a little bit dramatic. However, the pizza button, that part is real. Starting next month, Domino's will release an actual little button for your home that will instantly order you a pizza. You program the button with a phone app, sync it to your phone using Bluetooth, and just hit the button for your favorite order. Because the physical, literal buy button, this is a thing now. Amazon tried those Dash buttons that would let you order Tide or Gatorade or Huggies with one press. You can use Amazon's Echo to instantly add things to your Amazon shopping list using your voice. And according to PC Magazine, Netflix has put out instructions for a do-it-yourself Netflix switch that you could build and program to turn down your smart light bulbs, get takeout, silence your phone, and turn on Netflix on the TV. Just hack that together with a Domino's button and you should never have to leave the house again. It may surprise you to know that Domino's considers itself one of the top e-commerce companies in the world, right up there with Apple. Kai Rizdahl spoke with Domino's CEO Patrick Doyle recently on our Corner Office podcast, which you can find at marketplace.org or your favorite podcast catcher. All right, we got to go. Marketplace's daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll see you back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.